United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Amanda L. Meredith presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning. I am Judge Meredith. I am joined by Judge Falvey and Judge Lauer. We are convened today by video conference to consider arguments in the matter of Charles J. Love, Jr. versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 21-1323. Will counsel, beginning with petitioner's counsel, please make your appearance for our record.
Thank you, Your Honor. John Niles, representing Mr. Love, the petitioner.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Amanda Haddock, representing the Secretary of Veterans Affairs. With me today is Selkit Caudill, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Thank you. I understand petitioner's counsel wishes to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. If counsel are ready, we will begin with petitioner's counsel. Mr. Niles, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Mr. Love is requesting relief from a withholding of monthly disability compensation that the Secretary unilaterally has imposed to prevent the possibility of an overpayment. The brief history here is that the Secretary has discontinued Mr. Love's total rating evaluation for prostate cancer and also has discontinued his entitlement to special monthly compensation. Mr. Love continuously has challenged the discontinuance's validity, and he's doing so in an action separate from this case, 21-1323. Mr. Love acknowledges that if the Secretary were to prevail in that validity challenge, then the discontinuances would stand with an effective date of December 1st, 2019. The problem that he seeks to address here is that the Secretary has already begun to implement the discontinuances by paying him less, by paying him monthly at the post-discontinuance rate rather than the higher pre-discontinuance rate and withholding the remainder of the funds. And he asserts that that is unlawful because Congress has made a policy choice for the Secretary to continue payment in circumstances such as this. And Congress has even added to that by providing claimants with substantive and procedural protections in overpayment proceedings. But because the Secretary is withholding the payment that in turn eliminates the possibility of an overpayment, the effect of that is to eliminate Mr. Love's access to those substantive and procedural overpayment-related protections. And so the net effect is that the Secretary is essentially replacing Congress's policy choice to favor the possibility of overpayment and to provide claimants with those protections, with instead the Secretary's contrary policy choice to do the opposite. And that is something the Secretary may not do. And so Mr. Love is asking this court to order the Secretary to stop the withholding of this monthly compensation. This morning, I intend to address further why that withholding is unlawful and then turn to this court's jurisdiction. And the withholding is unlawful for three reasons. The first is that Congress has specified in 38 U.S.C. sections 1110 and 1114 that and what the Secretary must pay monthly. Congress also has laid out when a discontinuance becomes effective. And the relevant statute for this case would be 5112B6, which addresses the effective date for a discontinuance or rating reduction that is based on a change in physical condition. Congress also has contemplated that these provisions, on the one hand, about what the Secretary must pay monthly, and on the other hand, about when these payments are effective and changes in ratings are effective, can and do result in situations that can create the possibility of an overpayment. And so there's a policy choice to have been made here, and Congress made it, the policy choice being, do you let these payments continue and have separate provisions addressing overpayments, or do you have the Secretary stop them now to prevent the overpayment from ever being created? And the policy choice that that Congress made here was to have the payments continue and to address overpayments separately. And so, for example, in Section 5302A, Congress provided a substantive protection for claimants in that situation of an overpayment having been created, directing that the Secretary shall not seek to recoup the overpayment if doing so would be against equity and good conscience. And in Section 5314B, adding procedural protections when the Secretary is seeking to recoup an overpayment by offset against monthly compensation, similar to what the Secretary already has implemented here. But because the Secretary has already begun to implement this reduction in monthly compensation, Mr. Love does not have access to this equity and good conscience protection or the procedural protections that Congress has provided for 5314B, and he never will. And so the Secretary's withholding contravenes Congress's intent to provide those protection and is unlawful for that reason, and that reason suffices for it to be unlawful.
Could I jump in there, Mr. Nunes? You pointed to protections that are afforded to a veteran after an overpayment has taken place. Why does that suggest that Congress intended that an overpayment should occur in the first place?
Because the protections, Your Honor, would never apply, would be meaningless for Mr. Love without the presence of that overpayment. Congress did not want the Secretary to come in and just by the rule of grab, take this money away. Congress is affording these, you know, is asking, in Mr. Love's circumstances, would it be equitable? Can the Secretary in good conscience withhold these monies? Is the Secretary providing these protections? And in providing those protections, Congress inherently is saying, we want for the claimant to be in a position to be able to pursue those protections, to ask for them, which Mr. Love...
I could jump in, but you're not suggesting that there's any statutory provision that explicitly tells the Secretary to provide these outlays of monies in this case, or suggesting that they must.
That is correct, Your Honor. The way that we see Congress's intent here is working through the existence of these overpayment protections that where the statutes would never be reached if the Secretary is shutting off the funds now. I am limiting my answer there to the context of overpayment. Looking more broadly, Sections 1110 and 1114, again, address that the Secretary, and we read them as requiring the Secretary to continue these payments monthly. And so that is the statutory authority for which we look to say that the Secretary has to keep paying at the rate specified in 1114 until the, and unless, you know, these discontinuances become final. This leads to a second reason.
Good morning,
why
Mr. Niles. If I could ask about that last comment about the payments have to continue until they are final. And you talk about that a lot in your brief, the finality of the discontinuance, I guess. Yet the regulation doesn't use the terminology you use, final decision. It uses final rating decision. And you're asking us to read that as the final appellate decision, I guess. Isn't there a distinction between those two? Are we making a final rating decision when we act on an appeal? Or is the Federal Circuit making the final rating decision when they act on an appeal?
So I understand Your Honor to be referring to 38 CFR Section 3105E, this reference to the final rating action.
That and your comment just now that the payments have to continue until there's a final decision.
Yes, Your Honor. And so the predicate here is with me starting with the statute. And so to the extent that the regulation contravenes the statute must control. But then looking at the regulation with 3105E's language of final rating action, Mr. Love certainly understands that there are two senses in the word final or finality can be used and are used in this system. One is to distinguish between an interlocutory decision and not. And the other is whether the period remains open to challenge a decision. And Mr. Love understands that under the AMA, which we're now in, that yes, until that reading action becomes final, meaning that there is no further opportunity to challenge it, that the Secretary may not be implementing this discontinuance. And the key distinction here, going back to between the effective date of the discontinuance and when the Secretary may begin to actually take the money away. And certainly it's the case that if Mr. Love were to not prevail in his validity challenge, he would owe this money that the Secretary should have been paying him from 2019 forward. And then is subject to any protections that he could claim in the overpayment context. And so the question is essentially, who is holding this money during the challenge? Is it the Secretary or is it the claimant? And Mr. Love is reading into this overall statutory system. We have 1110 and 1114, where Congress is telling the Secretary to pay monthly. And 5302, 5314, where the Secretary is providing these substantive and procedural protections, other regulations that the Secretary has promulgated, also to provide substantive and procedural protections from overpayments, that the Secretary may not be holding on to this money while the challenge to the reduction is pending, or until it becomes final in the sense of no further review is available. And so that is where he sees where we're at. And so this second reason why the
Do you know of any analogous situation where payments would continue until the exhaustion of appellate review?
I'd ask that Your Honor please clarify that question. I'm not sure. I just want to make sure I'm answering what you intend.
Well, you're suggesting that the law requires these payments, these monthly payments, to continue until the exhaustion of appellate review, until the finality of the last appeal. Do you know of any analogous situation where government payments continue through appeal, or even other payments?
I am struggling on the spot to think of one, certainly beyond the context of veterans law, but within the context of veterans law, one loose analogy that is coming to mind, and it is loose, but the case of Frost, right, where this court held there's no temporal element in looking at secondary service connection about, just when the Secretary, if you will, implemented a recognition of service connection for a primary and then secondary disability. That's at least, I think, very loosely analogous. Something else that's coming, and I apologize for not being more helpful here, Your Honor. That is my own limitation. Returning to the second reason why this is unlawful, though, is because it does violate fair process. And I think it just does relate, Your Honor, because we are within the veteran system, which is uniquely proclaimant. And we have this statutory creature of fair process that says if an action that the Secretary is taking does not comport with basic notions of fair play with which Congress has suffused this entire system, it's not going to be allowed. And again, that is a statutory matter. And so when Congress is on the one hand providing these overpayment related protections, this inquiry into equity and good conscience and these notice requirements that the Secretary's unilateral upfront withholding pulls the rug out from under, that violates fair process. And so it's fundamentally unfair. And so for that reason, it's unlawful as well. I'll add, too, that there's not only Congress's protection, but again, the Secretary provides additional protections in the and rights in the context of overpayment that Mr. Love, as things currently stand, will never be able to access solely because the Secretary has gone in and just taken the action of stopping these pre-discontinuance payments. And so regardless of what the law does outside of the context of the veteran sphere, here I think this is further indication that Congress intends to hold these protections open for our country's veterans, their dependents, their survivors. A third reason why the withholding is unlawful is because it misinterprets the Secretary's own regulation at 3105E. And we touched on this.
Sorry for interrupting. Mr. Niles, may I ask a question, please? Your argument is that this would violate, going back to the second point that you just completed, that it violates fair process. But doesn't the 60-day period provided under Section 3.105 for the petitioner to present additional evidence after the VA proposes a discontinuance offer fair process?
Not enough, Your Honor. And the reason is that Mr. Love will never get back that inquiry into equity and good conscience. He will never get back these ability to, if there is an overpayment that is created and not waived, to work with the VA on payment terms that work with his budget, that don't put him in a very severe financial hardship, that are just fundamentally better for him than the Secretary coming in and just taking the money away with no process at all, which is what happened here. And so, again, that's fundamentally unfair. And also, I led with the specific statutory provisions because I believe that it violates them as well. The third reason why the withholding is unlawful is because, it misinterprets the regulation at 3105E, where 3105E mirrors the promulgation statute, which, again, is 5112B6, in terms of addressing when a discontinuance becomes effective. And so making this distinction between the effective date on the one hand and on the other hand, when the Secretary may begin to implement it. And the Secretary's error is misinterpreting 3105B to speak to both effective date and when the Secretary may begin to implement the discontinuance. When again, it speaks only to the effective date, and this is something where, again, by 105E itself contemplates this possibility of overpayment with, again, all of those protections that come along with it.
Mr. Niles, does the statute of regulation ever talk about or make this distinction between implementing an effective date that you're making?
There is no express provision that says, on the one hand, effective date, on the other hand, implementation. But the choice of language effective itself goes to this. And I think that one, I'd like to direct the court's attention to attachment B of the Secretary's response, which is the October 1st, 2019 notice letter that the Secretary provided to Mr. Love about this discontinuance action. And this notice letter does speak, it has a boilerplate statement about implementation, but it does that in the context of if benefits are granted. And it says that if payments are due, being due to the veteran, you should receive your first payment, if not already in receipt of payment, within 7 to 10 days of this notice. And so the Secretary does know well the difference between, on the one hand, effective date, and the other hand, the implementation date, when these payments are being exchanged. And so I'll add to
that, that kind of makes sense that, obviously if the they give notice of the discontinuance and they tell the veteran that this will take effect in 60 days. And that way it's kind of prospective that it's going to take effect no earlier than that date. It also gives the veteran the opportunity to submit additional evidence, thereby dispute the discontinuance, which I suppose could create a scenario where after review of that information, the 60-day prospective effective date has come and gone. But when they make the decision, the final rating decision, the effective date, that decision being made after that 60-day period, that the effective date is the one that was noticed. the notice was given. You'd like us to take that all the way to final appeal, right? Not when they review the response to the notice letter and they act on it. You'd like us to take that kind of implementation date and stretch it. That's kind of a pejorative way to say it, but you want us to that by law goes to final appeal. That's your position.
In a vacuum, Your Honor, yes. But looking more broadly, I think the real solution here is this. The Secretary is already providing this notice letter about the discontinuance action. It's already telling the veteran or the claimant when this discontinuance is going to become effective. It already has boilerplate in there that if this were instead a grant, that it would start being implemented. That same letter provides an opportunity for the Secretary to just provide notice and an opportunity for the claimant to make an informed choice here. And this is maybe going a bit beyond the petition, but this is the solution, I think, going forward, where the Secretary says, hey, look, we now have this issue of your effective date for your discontinuance is December 1st, 2019. We're providing you notice of your appellate rights. You can absolutely challenge this validity. In the meantime, we've got to figure out what to do about who holds the money. And so on the one hand, the Secretary could continue to hold the money if the claimant wants that. And I represent clients who would want to make that choice. This, you know, they could see this as financially disruptive. They don't want to deal with overpayments in the future. I think many veterans would make that choice. But on the other hand, the Secretary providing notice of saying, if you want us to keep paying you, that does create the possibility of an overpayment. Here are the overpayment related protections that you have. How do you, veteran, want or claimant want to be handling this?
If I could jump in there, I see we're running low on time, and I'd like to turn to the jurisdictional issue as opposed to the merits of your arguments. You said in your reply to the Secretary's response that the regional office and the board would not have jurisdiction over the question that we're debating as to whether the reduction should be implemented prior to final appeal being taken. I want to ask you a few questions about that because, as you know, under Section 511A, the Secretary shall decide all questions of law and fact necessary to a decision under a law that affects the provision of benefits, and then the board, in turn, has jurisdiction to review a decision by the Secretary under 511A. So why wouldn't the Secretary have jurisdiction to issue a decision as to when the benefit reduction should be taken? Are you suggesting that that does not involve a matter under a law affecting the provision of benefits?
I'll lead by saying that Mr. Love would welcome an interpretation of 511 that under which the Secretary's unilateral action here would be reviewable by the board. But when he looks at the text of 511A, he sees the Secretary shall decide all questions of law, in fact, necessary to a decision by the Secretary, and distinguishing between the decision by the Secretary versus a, if you will, non-decisional action. And so here there...
Ask the Secretary to make a decision on when the reduction should be implemented?
Mr. Love never had the opportunity, Your Honor, because the Secretary just went ahead and started implementing and started reducing these questions. And so
after the implementation took place, though, the petitioner has never asked SBA, can I get an RO decision on the question of when implementation should take place?
That is correct, Your Honor.
So if this is a 511A matter, though, that could have been appealed, you could have asked for a decision via, if they refused, you could seek a petition to force a decision. If it's a 511A matter, how is the petition not a vehicle to bypass that appellate process on the separate question of implementation date?
In that scenario, it certainly would be. Absolutely. We would have a problem under All Writs Act in aid of this court's 7252A jurisdiction on this prong of adequate alternative. On 7252C, which Mr. Love is arguing provides this court with jurisdiction in aid of the Federal Circuit jurisdiction, there's no case law on that whatsoever, and it is certainly possible that this court could bring in the same sort of adequate alternative requirement for that, in which case Mr. Love still would be out of luck as far as this petition goes, but would be able to pursue that relief before the secretary.
Do all of the jurisdictional arguments come back to the 7252C argument?
No, Your Honor, they do not.
Block, could you please add 5 minutes?
And thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Love, again, is interpreting 511 and understands 511 to where this withholding of funds is not a decision, but is instead is a non-decisional action. So we do need to stick with that premise. And within that premise, he sees that there's no adequate alternative to come to this court to challenge the withholding. And that withholding is eliminating all possibility of him ever seeking overpayment-related protection, which he would seek if he had the chance. He would argue for a waiver at least, saying that it would not be in equity or good conscience for the secretary to recoup what would be the overpayment, these same funds. And at that point, he would get a decision on that. That would then open up the traditional appellate pathway to this court. But because the secretary is withholding the money and eliminating that option for him, the secretary is impeding, well, entirely obstructing this court's traditional appellate pathway.
If turning back to Section 511A, if this is not a 511A matter, and neither the secretary nor the board could answer the question of when implementation should take place, then how would this court have authority to answer that question that the VA cannot?
We see 511 as saying the secretary shall decide these questions of law and fact necessary to a decision, but that does not deprive the veteran of resolving errors of law on these non-decisional actions. And so in 1988, when Congress created this system of review, including this court and the Federal Circuit, of review over Department of Veterans Affairs actions, we understand Congress to have intended to provide the claimant with this, if you will, protection, this judicial review of the entire range of VA errors purely of law and constitutional errors that VA can commit.
So regardless of whether answering the questions about the particular question of law would lead to or has led to a board decision, so it does come back to your 7252C argument.
That one does, Your Honor, where it, not a poor decision, but an erroneous decision, either as a matter of pure law or as a matter of the Constitution. Yes, Your Honor. And so with 7252C, this court, again, acting in aid of the jurisdiction that this court has granted, or that, sorry, that, that Congress granted the Federal Circuit to resolve these disputes of pure law and of the Constitution, and then interposing this court between the agency action and the Federal Circuit taking up those cases. And so this court having the jurisdiction to perform that function, perform that role, and protect veterans from that type of legal or constitutional error.
One last question on 511A, if I could. Assuming this is a Section 511A question and that the petitioner could go to VA and ask for a decision on when reductions should be implemented. And assuming you have exhausted and your remedies and we have jurisdiction, what would we have the authority, what relief could we provide? Could we answer that question ourselves, or will we just be limited to ordering VA to render a decision on that question?
Oh, I see, because Your Honor, I would interpret the secretary that the fact of the secretary's withholding here is, in some sense, an operative action where the secretary is making known what Mr. Love submits as erroneous as a matter of law position that the secretary can begin implementing the discontinuance now. And so on that understanding, this court would not be limited to remanding or sending this back to a for a decision, but instead could see the Secretary's act of withholding as being reflective of a decision that is erroneous as a matter of law, and then under 7261A2, ordering the Secretary to end that withholding. And that is the relief that Mr. Love seeks, is an order under 7261A2 to compel the Secretary to end this unlawful withholding.
I see we're, again, almost out of time. Judge Fowley, did you have further questions?
I'll wait for rebuttal.
Judge Lauer?
No further questions. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Niles, could you please wrap up?
Thank you, Your Honor. And just to wrap up again, Mr. Love respectfully requests that this court grant the petition and order the Secretary to release these payments at the pre-discontinuance level. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for the Secretary, you may proceed, and you have five additional minutes if you'd like.
May it please the court. Petitioner's argument that 38 U.S.C. Section 7252C vests this court with jurisdiction to order his desired relief is not supported by the plain language of the statute or the precedent of this court and the Federal Circuit. As such, the only potential means for exercising jurisdiction would be under the All Writs Act. However, petitioner has failed to demonstrate that he is entitled to such a writ and the petition must be denied. Specifically, jurisdiction pursuant to Section 7252 requires a board decision, which we do not have here. And petitioner has not demonstrated that he does not have adequate alternative means for relief or that this action is in aid of the court's prospective jurisdiction as required by the All Writs Act. In Gardner-Dixon versus Wilkie, the court recognized that Section 7252 grants it jurisdiction over board decisions. Similarly, in Jarrell versus Nicholson, the court explained that it does not have jurisdiction to review a claim absent a board decision on the matter in dispute. And in Scar versus Wilkie, the court noted that the jurisdictional requirement of a board decision is not waivable. These cases interpret 7252 generally. They do not limit to consideration of 7252A, and a statute must be read as a whole, rather than focusing on its component parts, as petitioner would have us do. The Federal Circuit has also made clear that a board decision is a statutory prerequisite to this court's 7252 jurisdiction. In Wick versus Brown, the Federal Circuit found that this court did not have jurisdiction to order VA to pay Wick attorney fees, as that the denial of those fees had never been the subject of a board decision. The Federal Circuit explained that it could not infer jurisdiction where it had not been conferred by Congress. And if Congress had intended the court's jurisdiction to be broader than that provided by 7252, which requires a board decision, it would have expressed that intention legislatively. Like in Witt, the matter at issue here has never been the subject of a board decision. In fact, in his reply and in his opening argument, petitioner admits that this is not an issue that falls within the board's subject matter jurisdiction. As this court explained in King versus Nicholson and Yee versus Principi, where the board does not have subject matter jurisdiction, neither does this court. Additionally, it cannot be overlooked that Section 7252 is entitled Jurisdiction, semicolon, Finality of Decisions. Therefore, contrary to petitioner's argument, it stands to reason that each subsection of 7252 does not necessarily deal with jurisdiction. Viewing the statute in this light, it is clear that subsection C is meant to relate specifically to finality of the court's decisions, and that those decisions are reviewable by the Federal Circuit. Viewing 7252C in this way does not render it duplicative of 7292. Rather, these sections work in tandem. 7252C specifically directs that decisions of this court are reviewable pursuant to the procedures set forth in 7292. Finally, with regard to the court's jurisdiction under 7252, because 7252 requires a board decision, petitioner's contention that 7261 allows this court to grant him the desired relief is fatally flawed. Regardless of the language in 7261 and its reference to Chapter 72 generally, Nowhere in Chapter 72 is this court vested with jurisdiction absent a board decision. With regard to the All Writs Act, petitioner has failed to demonstrate that he does not have adequate alternative means of a...
Good morning, Ms. Cuddle. Hi. I have a question. How does... Is the argument that the secretary... Or not the secretary... Mr. Love is making, Mr. Niles, on behalf of Mr. Love, is it not unlike the argument that was made in the Wolf petition? There was no final board decision, yet the court found jurisdiction.
So in this case, Your Honor, we would disagree that this case is similar to the case in Wolf, because here we have no action instituted before the agency, which is necessary for this court's jurisdiction under the All Writs Act, regardless of whether we have a final board decision, which would vest this court with jurisdiction under 7252. We again have no action initiated before the agency with regard to the payment of benefits at the pre-reduction rate that this court can link its jurisdiction under the All Writs Act to. It's long been recognized that in order for mandamus relief to be in aid of a court's jurisdiction, an action has to have been initiated at the agency. In Marbury versus Madison, the Supreme Court acknowledged this requirement when it noted that Marbury had not instituted any proceedings below, and thus his requested relief could not be in aid of this court's prospective jurisdiction. Again, petitioner has made no request to VA and to that the agency continue his payments at the pre-reduction rate. And therefore, we cannot consider, or we do not have an action initiated before the agency. The argument that mandamus relief would be an aid of this court's potential jurisdiction over a potential appeal related to a potential overpayment is simply too attenuated to be considered in aid of this court's jurisdiction as required by the All Writs Act. Additionally, if we were to consider the appeal of the reduction itself, which is pending before this court, to be that action instituted at the agency, we must then return to the fact that petitioner has failed to demonstrate that he does not have an adequate alternative means to obtain the relief sought by virtue of that appeal. If he is successful in that appeal, he will effectively obtain the relief he seeks through this action. While they are wholly separate actions, the appeal of the reduction and the request for payment at the pre-reduction rate, again, the effect of the actions is the same.
Well, I think Mr. Niles would disagree. He would say that for the period of time from 2019 until that court decision, he would be denied his rights to seek overpayment protections. And he'd also have the opportunity to have the use and benefit of the money during those interim months.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would expect that to be petitioner's position on that as well. But in that situation, what we need to look at is while there are overpayment protections in place and afforded to veterans in the event an overpayment is created, those protections are not in place to allow VA to purposely or knowingly create overpayments. Those protections are in place to protect veterans when, for example, an overpayment is created as the result of VA error, and it would be contrary to equity and good conscience to collect that debt based on the fact that it was erroneously created by VA itself. Here, petitioner would ask us to knowingly create an overpayment, and while he argues that the agency is currently unlawfully withholding benefits, that's not the case, and that is premised on a flawed interpretation of 3.105E.
Is it your position then that not only would intentional overpayments not be unlawful, the withholding of the overpayments would not be unlawful, but that intentionally making overpayments would be unlawful as contrary to the statute, contrary to the regulation, contrary to the Anti-Deficiency Act, the Appropriations Act, those sorts of things, Appropriations Clause?
Yes, Your Honor, that would be our position, that knowingly creating an overpayment would be an unlawful action by VA. And VA is congressionally mandated to avoid improper payments consistent with the Improper Payment Elimination and Recovery Act of 2010 in paying petitioner, paying petitioner the benefits of the pre-reduction rate while that appeal is pending would be an improper payment, as he has been determined to not be entitled to payment at that rate. Pursuant to 3.105E, it's clear from the reading of that regulation that final rating action was used for the sole purpose of differentiating from the term proposed rating action used earlier in the regulation. Nothing in 3.105E suggests that VA intended the term final rating action to be synonymous with finally adjudicated claim as contemplated by 3.160D. Further, again, as I just touched on, petitioner, while he argues that he's entitled to payment at the pre-reduction rate and that VA is unlawfully withholding compensation, he overlooks the fact that agency decisions are binding on the agency when they are promulgated as set forth by 38 CFR section 3.104, even though those decisions are reviewable by the board. As the agency explained in February and October of 2019, because of the improvement in his condition, petitioner was no longer entitled to a 100% rating for prostate cancer. Therefore, he's not currently entitled to payment at that rate in the resulting SMC benefits. While on appeal of the reduction itself, the court may determine otherwise in order that the prior rating be restored. Until and if that occurs, petitioner is not entitled to payment in at the pre-reduction rate, as his prostate cancer is no longer active and therefore does not warrant a 100% rating and thus the associated SMC. So VA is not unlawfully withholding benefits. Further, if VA is not permitted to implement a reduction until the appeal period had elapsed or appellate review had completed, as petitioner suggests, then the due process procedure set forth by Congress in 38 U.S.C. 5112b6 would be superfluous. As this court noted in O'Connell versus Nicholson, the advance notice required when a rating is to be reduced allows a veteran to not only present evidence for why the rating should not be reduced, but also allows them to adjust and prepare for the upcoming decrease in compensation payments. If Congress had intended that the reduction not be implemented until a year or more after the rating decision was issued, the advance notice procedures were wholly unnecessary, which would be contrary to the Supreme Court's mandate that every word of a statute be given effect. The argument that VA is required to pay veterans at the pre-reduction rate is also contrary to VA's duty to accurately rate and compensate veterans for their current level of disability and would result in compensation payments remaining unchanged for years following actual improvement in disability. Additionally, requiring VA to continue paying at the pre-reduction rate, as we've discussed, would result in the creation of overpayments for countless veterans, the majority of which would have no desire or even intention to appeal the reduction. Knowingly putting a veteran into debt, a debt that they may be liable for, is not a veteran-friendly practice. While overpayment protections exist in the form of waiver, deferral, or possibly compromise, none of those are guaranteed, and it would not serve veterans to knowingly create an overpayment that may not be waivable. Looking at this in the broader context, VA is currently actively trying to collect over $2 billion in compensation and pension debt related to overpayments. Directing VA to knowingly create additional overpayments, adding to that total debt, would be in direct contradiction to a VA's duty to be a responsible steward of taxpayer dollars. It would violate VA's congressionally mandated requirement to avoid improper payments. The process that is currently in place, allowing for restoration of a rating and payment of retroactive benefits if the reduction is overturned, best serves veterans by not putting them into debt and best serves the United States taxpayer and the government. A decision in favor of petitioner would have the effect of resulting in an overpayment, and that would take away funds that could be paid to other veterans who are entitled to compensation. So again, we cannot emphasize enough that the practice of knowingly putting a veteran into debt is not a veteran-friendly practice. and therefore 3.105E cannot be read to require payment at the pre-reduction rate while the appeal of that is that reduction is pending. There's no distinction between implementation and effective date in the regulations, and therefore there's nothing to support petitioner's argument that VA is unlawfully withholding payment.
Ms. Haddock, if I could, I'd like to follow up on your responses to some of Judge Valli's questions. Just to be clear, is VA conceding that under Section 511A, the Secretary could issue an appealable decision as to whether it is appropriate to pay the post-reduction rate while an appeal is still pending as to the reduction?
It is our, thank you for your question, Your Honor, but it is our position, the Secretary's position, that this is not an issue contemplated by Section 511A, that it is not a law that affects provision of benefits by the Secretary, that a veteran would be possibly entitled to payment at the pre-reduction rate and for VA to knowingly create an overpayment. So no, we do not believe that this is something that falls within that classification.
That the Secretary couldn't issue a decision as to whether it is appropriate to implement the reduction before the veteran has exhausted appeals. You're saying that's not a 511 question, just whether it's appropriate.
Correct, Your Honor.
Can you explain that to us? Because the reduction here was taken pursuant to 3.105E, and the authority for 3.105E is 5112B6, dealing with the effective dates for reductions in VA benefits. So if the veteran, this petitioner, came in and asked VA, please render a decision under 5112 and 3.105E as to whether it's appropriate to pay the post-reduction rate during this period, you're saying the Secretary would not issue a decision?
I can't certainly say that it would, VA would not issue a decision, but what I would say, Your Honor, is that argument is essentially a challenge to the reduction itself. Challenging a reduction under 3.105 and challenging the reduction under 5112 would certainly be a matter within USC 511A. But here, petitioner has consistently made clear that the challenge of the reduction itself and this action that he be paid at the pre-reduction rate are completely separate actions. While he has challenged the reduction pursuant to 3.105 and 5112, that is a wholly separate action than this action that he continued to be paid at the pre-reduction rate, which while he has argued that 3.105E supports that he received those payments, it's not a specific challenge to the law affecting the provision of benefits outside of the reduction context. So we would argue that the reduction itself in the administrative appeal process for the reduction is the proper avenue to challenge the payment issue.
Judge Falvey, were you trying
to
jump in?
I was just going to interject. You keep saying reduction, but you mean discontinuance, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I apologize. If there are no further questions, for the reasons stated today and those articulated by the Secretary in his response, the court should deny the petition as it does not have jurisdiction over this matter pursuant to 7252, and petitioner has failed to demonstrate entitlement to a writ. Thank you.
Judge Valli, did you have any further questions?
Yeah. So if we agree with you that it is lawful to implement the discontinue rating, do we need to address Mr. Niles' argument about 7252C at all, or even consider the All Writs Act, given that at least the All Writs Act is premised on that there's been a wrong done that needs to be remedied? And if there's no wrong here, do we even need to go through the All Writs Act analysis?
The jurisdictional question here, I think, is is the first question that needs to be answered, and it is the secretary's position that the court does not have jurisdiction over this matter. And
that's
so,
the 7252C argument?
Yes, Your Honor. 7252C does not vest this court with jurisdiction. And I think before the court can say that the action, there is no unlawful withholding, the court cannot get to that question without first determining that it has jurisdiction over the petition as a whole. And if the court does not have jurisdiction, which the petitioner has failed to demonstrate that the court does have jurisdiction, the petition should be denied on that basis.
Okay.
The lack of jurisdiction.
And so if we take that question up first and we agree with you and say there's no jurisdiction under 7252C for us to take action on this petition, we don't need to reach the question of whether or not the implementation of the discontinuance was unlawful.
Correct, Your Honor. We would argue that reaching that question would be beyond the court's capability, given that it did not have jurisdiction over the petition.
We'd still have to do the determine whether or not we had jurisdiction under the All Writs Act.
Correct.
And your position is we do not there either?
Correct, Your Honor. As there has
because
been no...
it's not in aid of our jurisdiction.
Yes. Correct, Your Honor. But if this court were to find otherwise that it does have jurisdiction over the matter pursuant to the All Writs Act, then certainly the court could reach the question of whether there is an unlawful withholding sufficient to warrant mandamus relief.
Thank you.
So again, if there are, I apologize. Go ahead.
Judge Lauer, did you have additional questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Ms. Haddock, you're welcome to wrap up.
So again, the secretary would maintain that the petition here should be denied as the petitioner has failed to demonstrate that this court has jurisdiction pursuant to 7252C and has failed to demonstrate entitlement to a writ. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haddock. Mr. Niles, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'd like to address two points, one jurisdictional and one on the merits. The jurisdictional point is to recognize overlap, but then where the parties part ways and their stances as to jurisdiction. And I think the parties agree that if this court has jurisdiction by operation of the All Writs Act in aid of this court's prospective 7252A jurisdiction, that should be enough here. The court would not then need to address 7252C. There certainly will be other vehicles for doing that. Now, I say that because, and I think this is where the parties do part ways, is that Mr. Love's position is that once this court takes up its jurisdiction, even if the All Writs Act is the avenue through which this court opens up the jurisdictional door, at that point, this court then can, should, and Mr. Love respectfully submits must compel the unlawfully withheld action under 7261A2. Irrespective of the All Writs Act's, we would say here, two requirements. The secretary argues three, adequate, alternative, clear, and indisputable relief. And then because this is an unlawful withholding case, Mr. Love argues that the third Carr or Cheney requirement does not apply here. And so that's the jurisdictional point I wanted to touch upon. On the merits, the secretary repeated that the VA cannot knowingly create an overpayment or cannot knowingly put the veteran into debt. That is not what Mr. Love is asking here. There is no knowledge of an overpayment will ever come to pass because, again, he has been continuously challenging the discontinuance's validity. And so it's this possibility here, and I think he'd acknowledge that at least there is a separate question or a broader, there would certainly be other provisions of law coming into play that are not currently present in this petition if this were a situation where a claimant were asking the VA to knowingly put that claimant into debt. Just a different situation entirely where Mr. Love does not agree with the discontinuances, do not believe they are valid, has been continuously challenging them. And the question then becomes, who holds the money during the course of that challenge? Everything else the secretary went through, I seemed familiar from the response and was already addressed in the reply. And so unless this court has any further questions, that is all that Mr. Love has for today.
Judge Valley, did you have additional questions?
I don't. Thank you very much.
Judge Lauer, do you?
I have no additional questions, Judge Marrone. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Niles, and thank you to Ms. Haddock. This case is submitted.
The court is in recess.